This is the Simon Dell Show, where we take a deep dive into some of the week's most notable business and marketing stories and interview high-performing business leaders and marketing professionals to find out their lessons for success.
Why we position ourselves as like a business within their business, so that everything we do has a brand associated to it. That brand is on an 18-month old.
Welcome to episode number 36, number 36 of the Simon Dell Show, and thank you very much for joining us on this journey. Today, we interview a gentleman by the name of Sam Hardy, who is the managing director of an organization called Peak Marketing. Now, Peak Marketing do pretty much large-scale product development for corporate companies. So Sam is the guy that will go and find best price, best products, ideas, creative, fun things for you as a business to either be selling or giving away to your customers. So anything from t-shirts to pinball machines. If you want to know where to get a pinball machine in China, Sam is the man, assuming that you want 500 of them, but I'm probably not sure that not as many people out there want 500 pinball machines. But look, it's a fascinating story and we have a great conversation about sourcing in China and the challenges of that, which is really quite interesting. So Sam is well worth listening to. Few other bits and pieces for the podcast as usual. If you want to come and talk to us, you can find me on LinkedIn, Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, although the Instagram has changed now. It's now simondell.com if you want to find us on Instagram instead of whatever it was before, but it's not what it was. It's now simondell.com. So you can find us on there. And you can email me simon@simondell.com. If you are looking for any sort of help in your digital marketing, no matter where you are in the world, we can give you help with that. Also, please remember to rate and review us on iTunes. That would be fantastic. And that's pretty much it. So enjoy the interview with Sam, and we will catch up at the end. I'm joined on the show today by Sam Hardy, who is the managing director of Peak Marketing, who are based here in Brisbane, and they are a product development company. We're going to find out all the sorts of bits and pieces that they do. So welcome to the show, Sam.
Thank you. Thank you very much for having me.
Now, first question, we ask this of everybody who comes on the show, but just to kind of understand who you are and where you came from, what was the first job that you ever did that you actually got paid for?
The first job I ever did was actually with the old company that I'm running now. I was painting the warehouse floors when I was 12 years old because I wanted a new drum kit.
Right. Okay. So you painted the floors. No toxic chemicals or at 12 years old, I take it.
No, but it was paint and it was the summer holidays. So because Dad didn't want dust blowing over the floors, I had to paint it with the roller doors down in one of the back warehouses in the shed. So it was pretty hot and hot. I didn't feel well by the end of the day, but after 3 days of it, I got a new drum kit, so it seemed all worthwhile.
Yeah, I was going to say, we should all be having a word with your father about child labour laws and things like that.
He's old school. Like, he used to trick us, like, even when we probably were a little bit younger than that, he'd say, all right, I'll pay you this much an hour, or I'll give you, you know, 5 cents to stuff envelopes or something with the checks that they used to send out. Right. And we used to go, oh, we'll take, you know, $20 an hour. That's unbelievable. Turns out it only took us about 2 hours to do the work.
Right. But you'd have been better off taking the 5 cents.
Hell yeah, we would have been. We would have made about $60 an hour. So after that, before I make a decision, I usually try and sit and work things out a bit quicker.
And so what was the drum kit? Was it like a brand that everyone, I don't actually know many brands.
It was a Pearl Export drum kit. So it was like an entry level kind of, and I've actually still got it.
Okay.
I've got it in the warehouse on a pallet wrapped up. I'd never sell it because I quite like the significance of it to me.
Yeah. Do you still play the drums?
Yeah, I got a drum kit in. I got an electric kit in my office, and then in one of the rooms downstairs, I've got a drum kit set up as well.
Do you do any sort of gigging or anything like that? Or?
I actually just do it to relax. Okay. I find you can really tune. Well, funnily enough, I actually find I can really tune out with it mentally,
yeah.
And just kind of sit there and bang away.
Mm. Oh yeah, I played the guitar for years in bands and things like that.
Yeah. But
I kind of gave up after I realized that I didn't really enjoy the practicing side of things. It wasn't, I didn't get that calmness from playing guitar or anything that I think a lot of people get from playing musical instruments.
Yeah, my wife gets it from running. Like she runs, right. And every step I take running is the most painful thing I ever do, and I hate it. I guess everyone gets it differently.
So the business that you've got at the moment was a second generation family business, yeah?
It is. It's got a little bit of an intermission in between. So we had a previous business, and then it had an office in North America in Toronto and Seattle, and we kind of moved around with it with Dad as he was growing it before we came back and to go to boarding school, and I worked in there. He came back to Australia more with Mum, and it was a substantially larger business than what we're operating at the moment. And I worked in the warehouses during picking orders and everything as a kid, which actually is really good now because when people complain about their work, I've done it. So, and then in about 2007, it was purchased by a bigger company. Then in 2010, that company was leveraged pretty heavily into US retail. So they actually went tits up. And I was a currency trader at the time, because funnily enough, Dad actually fired me the day I finished university and told me to get a job in the real world. So I got a job in an investment bank, which is probably the real world thing that you could do. And he called me up and he said, look, you've probably got an opportunity that if you want to, pick up some of the old clients that I can, give you a year or two and then you can go on your merry way from there. So I was living in North America at the time. And it was about the third day of negative 30. And I was like, yeah, get me out of here.
what made you, aside from the weather, what made you sort of chuck in the whole currency trading
thing? I don't know. Like, there's a lot of freedom that you get with running your own race, but there's a lot of constraints as well. It's quite an oxymoron because you are really constrained, to the beast, the business, but you do get a lot of freedom around it. Working with Dad was always a big draw card, especially in a more professional, capacity. So, it seemed like a good opportunity, and I kind of left on a really good note with the bank I was with. So there was always a window with our CEO who I still talk to. Like, I was talking to him probably a couple of months ago when I had a problem here. There was always the opportunity that I could go back if it didn't work. So didn't have kids, didn't have a mortgage, that's when you try everything.
Yeah. When your father sold the business and then 3 years later, presumably bought it back for, I'm going to presume he bought it back for less than he originally sold it for.
Yeah, pennies in the dollar.
Yeah, yeah. So he's kind of got the best of both worlds there for that.
Yeah. Yeah, we were pretty fortunate.
Was there, what was he doing in that time? Was he just, was he going, right, well, I'm out of this now? Or was he still working in the business? Was that part of the deal when he sold it?
No. So he was probably a 3 year gap that he wasn't working. He stayed on for about 12 months, as part of the deal. And he would, surfing on boats,
people doing. Spending the money.
Yeah, basically. So
as we would all do in that
in those circumstances.
That's right.
Yeah.
Yeah. So he was enjoying himself. And see, the thing was, like, you know, we've got customers that used to come over to our house for dinner when I was 7 years old, 8 years old.
Right.
So a lot of them were, you know, called him up and like, well, you got us into this mess with these idiots. You know, you got to get us out of it. And he's like, all right, well, I'll talk to Sam and see how we go.
Yeah.
So that was part of they said, well, he said, look, I can put you with other people or, you know, we can kind of, I'll start Sam again. Yeah. I'll get Sam back and we'll go it again. And they said, all right, well, provided that you're involved and it's not like up for sale, that you're not just going to, you know, flick it in 12 months time. Once you get us all back, they're happy to continue with us. So that worked well.
Yeah. Yeah. What, when you started again, I mean, obviously you had a little bit of a luxury, the fact that you had a base of clients already.
Yeah.
And I guess that kind of helps in terms of things like cash flow and all those bits and pieces. What else did you do when you restarted the business? Was there anything that sort of you kind of went, right, day one, I need people to know about this? What steps did you take there?
Day one was updating our platform for that, because we run like corporate online stores for at least one channel of our business. So it was making sure that we weren't like everyone. The old business when it was in the transition period of going down, there was a lot of things that they could have been doing better. And, you know, one of the things that I saw was that we really needed to update our online platform. So, you know, people became accustomed to shopping on ASOS or shopping on Net-a-Porter or shopping on StrawberryNet, you know, and there was no point in comparing what we were doing to the rest of our industry, because we're always going to be comparing ourselves to, you know, to competitors. Like, let's look at what is being done in a retail platform and what people are actually used to doing, and let's strive to achieve to get the business to that point. So, you know, updating that online platform was a big thing that we needed to do. And then looking, you know, starting to invest in the creative side of the business. So getting a few more designers on board that'll, you know, keep everything fresh and exciting, because, you know, in our industry, there's only so many hats you can give away, or you know, 50,000 pens. Like they all just blend into each other after a while. So we needed to have the creative focus that, you know, the creative stuff is what kind of gets you in the door with our clients.
Right.
But the support and the logistics and the warehousing and the operation side is typically what keeps you there. Because
just taking a step back there, I just want to kind of understand. You talk about updating the online platform.
Yeah.
How do you, just for people who don't understand this space, how do you work with the clients? Are you delivering them the full e-commerce solution as well at the end, or?
That's exactly right. So we will run like companies' online merchandise stores. So, you know, so we've not only run it, like we fund it. So we've got some of our customers that we actually own the inventory. It's part of the contract. The contract that we've got, you know, we own it. We build them as they send it out. So,
give me an example of a not necessarily name a customer, but a markets a segment or an industry where you would be doing that.
So, you know, earth moving equipment as an example. So
okay, right.
And big mining equipment. So.
Yep.
You know, when they sell a machine, there's X amount built in for merchandise.
Yeah.
And they'll place the order online. And you know, we've got, with one customer, we've got about probably 15 SKU lines of caps. We've got probably 10 or so jacket lines, you know, a few different T-shirts, models, all that stuff.
Yeah.
And all that collateral, so that when they sell one of these machines and they're about to deliver it, you know, they'll log in, they'll say, we want 15 of those, 20 of that, 40 of those. And then we'll, you know, pick it, pack it and ship it out the door, because it's already sitting in our warehouse ready to go.
Okay.
And then we've got the other side of the business, which is like made to order, where we'll be doing, you know, 500. One of the boys was up in China 2 weeks ago looking at pinball machines for an alcohol company.
Right.
So, and that'll come into our warehouse. We'll QC it here, although we would have QC'd it with our China office, you know.
By QC, you mean quality control?
Yeah. So we've got, I think we're up to like 15 people in our in our Ningbo office now. Right, predominantly, okay. About 10 of them are purely quality control people. And they're on the road all the time just inspecting everything.
Give me a sort of scale of like the smallest items that you would be doing this for up to, say, the largest items. I mean, you've said things like T-shirts and stuff like that. Is that as kind of small as you go, or?
No, I think we just did some lapel pins for a real estate company.
Okay.
But like one off, we would kind of shy away from that.
Yeah.
But
we've got
the Australian New Zealand contract to supply everything. So it's, you know, we look at it as a totality thing, not just the single order.
And up to what sort of size? What, you know, obviously you mentioned the big digger companies and things like that. But how big would be your biggest client?
Oh, probably, you know, market cap circa $17-18 billion.
Okay, that's not small.
No, so yeah, you know, we deal with airlines, earth moving equipment. Yeah, I think one of the US companies is probably about a $20 billion company. So yeah, we've got a wide variety.
Talk to me about the pinball machines and alcohol, because they're two things I'm big fans of.
Yeah.
Are the alcohol company coming to you with the idea of saying we want a pinball machine?
No.
And or are they sitting down with you and they're working through those ideas with you?
Typically, we'll do planning sessions throughout the year, and we do them like with all of our key kind of major clients. We do like quarterly business reviews, and a big component of that is, apart from reviewing our performance as a company with the service we offer, a big component of those is, you know, planning for what's coming up, you know, 3 months, 5 months, 6 months, 24 months down the line, because a lot of our things do take a lot of time to come to fruition. And, you know, it's not just getting it to pre-production stage, it's everything before that, like the tooling and everything. So, you know, we'll sit down there and I may say, look, in summer 2020, we want to be doing a big gift for our anniversary of this brand. We've got, you know, $5,000 to spend per item, and we want to do 500 items. Can you come back to us?
Right.
And we go away and we go, all right, well, Jesus, what are we going to do? And we start playing around with some ideas, and, you know, I think we put a few things forward, and we're kind of, you know, just finalizing how we're going to, what we need to do to see if this pinball machine will be a starter for them.
They've come to you with the idea. They've got $5,000. They want 500 of them. Where do you and the team start from a creative perspective? Is it things that you already know are out there that you can source?
It's usually from, like, we don't consider ourselves product movers as a business. You know, we really do get to really, really understand, like, what our customers want and what environment they want them in. So we try and we'll go, whether we do the 12-month surveys with their customers, just so we can see what markets they're into and what kind of gets them excited.
Yeah.
So we really try and understand the target market, the position, and where they want these things to end up. A great example of it is whoever came up with the Commonwealth Bank dollar mine concept in the 80s was a genius, because my sister still uses CBA today, because she got given a money tin in grade one. And now her mortgage and everything is with the CBA, because she just didn't really want to move, and she got hooked on it that way. So it's about understanding what the objection is, the objective of the promotion is. So once we understand that, you know, then we start working ideas up from there, and, you know, sit in the office on a Thursday night and, you know, crack open a few beers or a few wines and get some takeaway and just start talking the ideas through. And, you know, like for one business, we ended up 1 year doing swags, a bunch of swags for them, camping eskies, camping house in fridges. And then someone just said, hey, we should do a racing simulator as well for the man cave.
Right.
And these guys, they're a tooling company, and these guys' business is, you know, they do a lot of motorsport sponsorship. And we're like, oh, yeah, we'll throw that in. And they went with all three of them. So you never know what is going to get the client excited. So we, you know, we pitch everything. We just render it up and go from there.
Do you, I mean, obviously in those circumstances, you probably get a lot of no's as much as you get some yeses.
Yeah.
How do you persuade the client that you're right and they're wrong? Do you kind of find that much?
It is like, we just recently had one that we submitted that we thought was a real, we got great feedback across the survey we did, and, you know, we tested it really, really well with even their branches. And, you know, they still didn't really think that it was going to be the right product.
Yeah.
And you know what? At the end of the day, we've got to respect that. And essentially, we'll try our best to convince them, or we'll present everything as to why we think it's a good idea.
Yeah.
But, you know, at the end of the day, it's their money. And if they choose to spend it elsewhere, then, you know, we've just got to dust ourselves off and keep going.
Do you get it the other way around, where they're telling you to source something and create something, where you sit there and think, God, that's a bit of a dog?
Yeah, sometimes we do. You know, we've had a big airline once that wanted to do this mass promotion for their corporate clients for umbrellas. Right. And they had a budget of like $10 an umbrella. No, even less than that, maybe $7.50 an umbrella. And I just kept saying to them, I was like, these are going to be crap. Like, you're not getting a good product at $7.50 or whatever it was. And I said, and the worst part about it is, it's not like it's a T-shirt or something like that. I said, it's an umbrella. People are only pulling them out when it's bloody raining.
Yeah.
So your brain is going to be associated with, this is a cheap, this
a miserable shit, day, yeah.
And I'm wet. And if they're cutting costs on umbrella, what else are they cutting costs on their planes? So I was like, I really, really don't think that we should do it. And I said, and we typically will provide some sort of guarantee on the product and stand behind it. But we just said to them, look, we can deliver it, but we're not going to be, you know, responsible for these things breaking. I said, because they will break at that price.
Yeah.
And, you know, young marketing person, nah, still wanted to go ahead with it. And then the CMO called me up and he's like, we're getting all these umbrellas breaking. And I just went, I'm going to send you an email, okay? And I said, wait while I'm on the phone to you. Yeah. And he said, leave it with me. And I was like, all right. So sometimes we try and advise, steer our clients away from things, and 99.99% of the time they listen, but there's always the one time when people, you know, and that's typically why we position ourselves as like a business within their business, so that they can listen to us. We don't have a lot of customers or clients where we're treated as the supplier. Like, you know, it'll be like, oh, well, if you guys don't think that's right, and we'll be like, no, we really don't think it is. And they'll go, okay, well, yeah, we will kind of listen to the voice of reason.
Yeah, I can imagine. I mean, I guess all people who work in any type of agencies and creative agencies get that issue all the time. And there's only so many times you can tell a client. And any time that you've been, that you thought something wasn't going to work and it did work?
Yeah. There has been. It was probably the biggest thing that we ever did was that I thought this is a crazy idea. And one of the creatives here said, no, swag's awesome. And I was like, I've never been in a position before in my life where I've thought, what's going to get me out of this pickle of swag? And we did it for a tool company. And they were all gone within about 72 hours, and there was about 600 of them.
Yeah.
They just flew out of their stores, and they really, really drove some sales because they packed a whole heap of margin into the products that you had to buy to get it. And, you know, it was circa probably about $2,000 worth of stuff. They went really, really well.
Wow.
And I was really surprised by that because I don't know. But then again, I wasn't their target market. Yeah. So, like, you know, I'm not a camp, like the idea of, an idea of camping is, you know, staying at a motel on the side of a highway type thing. So I'm not their market, but you know, it's, I'm not here to do that. We're here to, you know, come up with the ideas, and it went really well. So that was good.
Is this the sort of thing that if somebody's sitting there listening to this going, oh, I've got a great idea for a product and I want to create a business out of it, are you the sort of people that people can come to and say, help me with this? Or are you more dealing with the corporate end of it? Or
we more deal with the corporate end of it.
Yeah.
You know, we typically don't do product development from the ground up for someone else to sell on. Everything we do has a brand associated
right.
to it.
Yeah. What are your suggestions in that sort of space? I mean, presumably you've had a few people knocking on your door that have asked those kind of things, but you guys would know, obviously, with people in China that the challenges of dealing with manufacturing
huge.
In there. What tell me what some of those challenges are, and what sort of advice would you give people who do want to go out there and source something off Alibaba or something?
It's just to be really, 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 really careful and do your homework. Like a perfect example is we had a company once that wanted 80,000 USBs, and I think she's like, oh, I can get them on Alibaba for $4. And we're like, well, we're $4.65. We're not going any lower. We can't go any lower.
Yeah.
That's a really good price that you're getting them for. And she was, again, a pretty junior person, submitted to a boss, got a pre-production sample from the factory, didn't plug it into her computer, and it actually didn't have any memory on it. So she got 80,000 products into Australia without any memory in them. They were just the USB. There was no flash in it. So there is things like it is.
Did she have to come back to you and buy it from you in the end? Or?
Yeah, she did. Yeah. Oh. Her boss, who's been a mate of dad's for years, called me up, and he's like, oh, look, he said, she's really upset. I need a solution. We'll go through it later. You can tell me what happened, but I just need a sign. I was like, they're $4.65. He said, okay, so this is going to cost us, you know, for another $300,000. So
Jesus.
They were like, oh, how much? I said, mate, just print some flyers. It'll be cheaper, to be honest. I said, just go to a print shop. And he did. They just went and got, like, so it didn't have the effect they wanted, but, knocking another $300,000 out of a budget's going to take a hit on any business.
No.
So, like, dealing with China is really difficult. And it is it's not even just a language thing. It's a culture thing. It is a timing thing. Like, everything takes a lot longer than what you would expect.
Yeah.
They avoid taking any form of responsibility. And if something does go wrong, where an Australian or a Westerner may say, all right, let's just fix it and move on, they will sit there and piss up 4 or 5 days trying to just cover their ass.
Yeah.
I've got a friend who's developed this fantastic product for kitchen tops, kitchen bench tops, and he's having great feedback, and someone's just signed an exclusive deal with him. And even he's like, oh, mate, can I borrow a girl from one of your offices? I just need her to go and check something for me. I'm just like, yeah, just throw on a plane. But it's a real difficult place if you're not up there. Now, you know, we've had factories that we've been dealing with for years and years and years that supply, you know, one of the major kind of retails in Australia that we look after. And we've been dealing with them for ages. And dad's principle on China is always like, you know, you see the Americans there and they're pretty good. You see the kind of East of the Europeans, and they'll just be trying to get the best price possible. Like, they're beating them over their head to get the price down. And, you know, Hong, who runs our China office, will be in kind of negotiations with the factory, and she's trying to get a better price. And Dad used to always be like, Hong, it's all good. We're making money. We need them to make money. Like, we don't want to be doing this negotiation every single year or having to second guess them. If they make a buck or two extra than what, if we cost us an extra $1, $1.50, you know, on 150,000 shirts, it's not a big deal, because we're still making money. Like, the whole supply chain needs to do well. And that's quite a unique way to approach to approach them. So that'd be my suggestion is it's they're really, they love saving face and they love like they're, yeah, making sure that, you know, really, really respectful is will go a long way with them.
Yeah.
But it is a tricky place to do business. Like it's not straightforward. And a lot, like we've seen a lot of, like we've seen a lot, because we're involved with it, you know, we've seen a lot of people take a pretty big haircut on some products because they've gone, oh, I'll just do it myself. Like, you know, not going up and like we inspect every factory before we put an order on them because just to make sure that we've got the peace of mind that we've, that they're actually real. They're not just a little unit in Alibaba, in on an Alibaba site working out of a one-bedroom apartment in Shanghai. Because there's no, you can't go, there's no legislation to protect yourself.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
If something goes wrong, there's a billion of, you know, 1.2 billion people. They're just going to, you know, disappear, just fade into the background and that's it. You're done.
Yeah. Yeah. What do you think in terms of, I mean, obviously there's been I sense there's starting to be a shift in terms of China's ability to produce things still as cheaply as potentially other countries can, or you know, maybe the Western world can start to produce.
Absolutely.
Do you think that power is waning a little?
I don't know if it's softening, but there's definitely a price. There's a lot of upward pressure on price at the moment.
Right.
You know, with so much tech coming out of China, people don't want to make cheap, low-end products when they're, you know, when they can try and get a job at a place that's making Samsung TVs, as an example. Like we had a t-shirt factory that we used to use, and after Chinese New Year, 50% of their workforce didn't go back to work because they could make more money putting phones together for HTC.
Right.
So there's what we're seeing is the lower end items, t-shirts, you know, pens and the kind of cheap knickknacks that you just give away.
Yeah.
A lot of that is moving into Southeast Asian countries.
Okay.
You know, we're doing a lot of apparel out of Vietnam now.
Okay.
You know, we steer clear of Bangladesh, India. There's a lot of human rights problems there that, you know, that our brands won't touch and therefore we won't touch. But you know, there's a lot of good kind of textiles are coming out of Vietnam at the moment, and I would think that that'll continue to shift down as you continue to get further price pressures in China, especially on the lower end stuff.
When back to talking about your own business, how do you grow that? How do you find new clients? Are they coming to you, or are you actively got some strategies out there to reach out to new business?
We're lucky enough we get both. You know, we do get a lot of referrals and a lot of people that will move from, you know, one marketing department to another. We get, if they're senior enough, we get dragged along. Because what we do is sort of unique. Our warehousing and distribution model is really, really handy, and it's all the way from large scale, you know, every Woolies in the country getting something, all the way down to someone just, you know, if your business does a lot of events, then as we typically pack everything up and kit it up before it gets to the show so people aren't stuffing event bags at 2 o'clock in the morning the day off. So we do get a lot of referral, but then, you know, we've got a lot of, we do have a big push with new business and people that's their job to be out there pitching, and they've got kind of KPIs around that. And all we do is we just go, well, this is how much new business we want every year. Work, break it down into little bite-sized pieces, you know, all the way down to the week. You know, we figure you've got to do about 20 new business calls a week to get to that number. So
are you heavily reliant on the outbound, you know, calls and knocking on doors and cold emails and that kind of thing? Or?
Yeah, we typically I don't really like cold emails. We we'll kind of target an industry and then we'll target an industry and start making calls from there. And then once we kind of get to the person we want to. If we get a meeting or if we get, you know, have a nice conversation with them, we'll send them, we'll do what our business does. You know, we'll send them a nice little something.
Yeah.
That'll probably have, we do encourage the guys to, you know, if they've got neat handwriting, to write a little note that just says, hey, you know, thank you for your time on the phone. If you're around next Tuesday, you know, we'd really like to catch up for a coffee. And we try and make it something that is going to be used, like practical. We do a lot of, like, there's, we've got a set of really nice double glass coffee cups.
Okay.
And we put two of them in there. And so it's like, hey, we'd love to catch up with a coffee. So it's a bit symbolic. And then, yeah, we go in and have a chat and ask a lot of questions about their business and what they're doing now. And, try and come up with a solution for them.
I guess that was going to be one of my next question, was your favorite, your most successful, best, favorite, however you want to phrase it, corporate gift. Something that you either like to give, or something that you, someone's given to you that you've gone, yeah, right, that's shit hot.
Do you know what is really funny? If it's a novelty gift type thing, I know it's lame, but I've got this power bank that I was given once.
All right.
And
it
charges everything so quickly. It's like, I'm like, I've written my name on every side of it so that people don't pinch it. And it's really, really useful. So I like products that I'm going to use.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
if it's not a clue, and my house isn't like an Aladdin's cave or anything.
That's good stuff.
But it's really good. I hate clutter, which is odd for the business of me. But I like things that I'm going to use,
yeah,
or that I'm going to get used. Like, I don't know who actually did it, but one of our competitors did the Westpac helicopter that is in the, that's a caricature, and it's a money, it's a little coin, little piggy bank, plastic piggy bank.
Yeah.
And I think if you opened a bump account with Westpac, they put $200 in it for you, but you can't touch it till they're 16 or whatever.
Right. Okay.
And my son loves this thing. And he's only like 18 months old, so you know, he's amused by a butterfly. But you know, he walks around with this thing everywhere. And I'm like, wow, that's really great. Like, that brand is on an 18-month-old, and you know, he's playing with a product that's, you know, that's their brand. So I like the practical ones. You know, some people, we've got one of the girls downstairs, she's got a drawer of pens, and they're all really neatly laid out. She collects pens, that's her thing. But the best kind of gimmicky one I think I've ever seen would have been, and we've got one in the showroom, it's a chopper bicycle, and that was just kind of neat, which was pretty cool. And we did motorized Eskies once, which was pretty funny. And we were racing them around our warehouse with helmets on, which is quite cool. There's heaps that I like the simple ones. And we actually did a knife last year for a Japanese customer, and it was apparently the sharpest knife in the world. I don't know how they test that. But we did that, and that was a really, really nice gift.
Okay, last three questions.
Yeah.
Number one, some brands that you admire, things that you buy all the time, or services that you always engage, things that you sort of aspire your company to follow from a brand perspective.
Yeah, there's a beef company up in North Queensland called Blackrock Beef Co.
Okay.
And they do four products, and they do them brilliantly, and they're a family business. You know, their father, the beef comes from their father's cattle property, you know, two young girls, and they, their packaging, their branding, it's all really clean. It's a great product as well, and it's really well priced, and I really like what they do. The next one would be probably, 2 weeks ago when I got the email, I would have said Tesla, but now I changed my mind.
It's a bit hard to talk positive about Tesla these days.
At the moment, it is, yeah. And a friend of mine's
Elon's still in charge, but
yeah. And a friend of mine's about to take delivery from a Model 3, and he's like, I really don't want it. Like, I've got to get out of this. The other one would be Patek Philippe. the watch company. I really, really like the way they position themselves as it's the one product you need for that brand. And you don't actually own it. You merely look after it for a second generation. The designs are easy to use. It's it's meticulously made. I aspire to own one myself. That's kind of like, that'd be my holy grail watch.
Yeah.
And then thirdly, funnily enough, it's JP Morgan from the banking days, but more so for their CEO, Jamie Dimon. I think what they've done with the brand and what they've done with that business has been pretty remarkable, and I think he's probably one of the best CEOs on the planet.
I'm just actually on the blackrockbeef.com.au website.
Oh, they're fantastic.
Yeah. I was going to say, it helps that the two girls involved are not exactly...
No, but the first, the dad... So I live at Hawthorne in Brisbane, and there's a place called the Hawthorne Garage, and it's like an IGA whatever thing, market thing. You know, you pay through the nose on it. But the old boy was there one time doing tastings because one of the daughters was sick, so he flew down. He's walking around there with his kind of big wide hat on. He had his arms on, and he was a top bloke. And I was like, God, all right, you know, young. That was probably about maybe 2 years ago that I had my first one, and it's, you know, it's just been actually great through their Instagram and through, you know, talking to him when he's back there once every 6 months type thing of how well the business is doing. It's really, really nice to see, and I think that. They take the headache out of cooking that type of product, but it's also the packaging is really, really nice. The product styling is beautiful.
Well, the website looks fantastic. You know, they clearly have got that right. So, you know, if the rest of it and just even the product photos, the food photos look great. And I've seen some incredibly poor styling of food photos in the past, but
I interned once at a company called Landor when I was at university in their accounts department, their WPP business. And yes, some of the efforts that they used to go to make crappy food photos look good for different brands boxes in supermarkets was pretty astonishing.
Second to last question, what's next for you guys? What have you got on the horizon? Is anything sort of any new ideas or innovation or anything that, you know, that we can know about?
We've got basic kind of offices and warehouse and distribution in New Zealand. We do want to have a bigger push into the New Zealand market.
Yeah.
We're also looking at how we can start to secure some larger global contracts with our current clients, warehousing and distribution out of a hub somewhere, whether it be near the border in China to Hong Kong in Shenzhen there. But yeah, that's kind of where we're looking to go. Much more of a global scale.
Yep.
And then looking at how we can have a different online offering for your ad hoc business as well.
Okay. So last question, if people want to talk to you, if they just want to ask you a question about product development or they've actually got something that they'd like you to work on, what's the best way of getting hold of you?
Just, I'll be the first to say I'm not very good at responding to emails. I'm a phone call person. So.
Are you? Okay. I did a talk this morning where I got everyone to put their hands up and says who never answers their phone or hates talking on the phone. And there was a lot of people put their hands up, including myself. Really? But
I'm
old school. You're old school.
I print my, if an email's got more than four sentences in it, I'll print it out and read it.
Like, Sam, the trees you're killing,
man. I know it's bad, but I recycle it all in my Iron Mountain box under my desk, so it does get a recycling.
All right, so nobody needs to email you; they just want to call you. Then I guess
just give us a call, yeah. Right.
And the number, they can find the number on the website.
Call my mobile; it's easier.
Yeah, no, let's not do you that. Let's not just in case you get some real cranks who listen to this podcast and then decide to call you. So. Mate, look, thank you very much for your time today. That's been really, really informative. Really appreciate it.
No, thank you.
Thank you for coming on the show and good luck with the growth.
Thank you. Excellent. Thank you very much.
That's it for today. That was episode number 36 with Sam Hardy from Peak Marketing. Hope you enjoyed that. Hope you learned something. Please, thank you for tuning in to this episode and all the other episodes that you may or may not have listened to. And if you do get a chance, go back and listen to some of them. So some really, really interesting content. Otherwise, we would love to see you back here again next week. So thank you.